Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Wave podcast. Appreciate you tuning in. Today I've got Sam Callahan on the podcast. We talk about Doge and their ability to pull out some of the corruption in government spending. We talk about tariffs and taxes, SAB 121 repeal, a whole host of topics. Really think you're going to enjoy this episode and get a lot out of it. Alrighty, like I said in the intro, I've got Sam here with me. Sam, welcome to the Bitcoin Wave podcast.
Thanks, Michael. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. Like I was telling you offline, there are so many things going on right now that I would love to hear your commentary on. And I think it would be very useful for a lot of people to sort of break down what these things are. Let's start with a tweet that you shared, though, about Doge. What you said was two things can be true at once. Doge will drive some positive change, reducing waste and corruption. Two, Doge will also fail to make a meaningful dent in the fiscal deficit. So first of all, I guess for clarity, we're not talking about Doge, the digital token. We're talking about Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency or whatever it's called. So why don't you, one thing I'm still not completely clear on is Doge's ability to act on anything that they find. It seems like more an investigative group, and ultimately maybe there's some other mechanism by which changes actually have to occur. But could you explain maybe Doge's mission, what sort of authority you understand them to have, and why, and I agree with your comment based on everything I know, why you believe what you said?
Yeah, well, that's a good question in terms of what they can actually legally get done. I mean, I don't think this has ever happened before in terms of, you know, basically you have like a executive order that creates this new Department of Government Efficiency. And it's like almost like an arm of the executive branch that's just going into the different departments. And there's a lot of question marks in terms of their access to confidential information and like whether they're allowed to see these things. And so I think there's a lot of question marks there in terms of what they can actually get done. Right now, it seems like they're kind of auditing things and figuring out where the government waste is. And we all know that there's a lot of waste. You know, I guess I first say that I support the mission. Like, I think the government's become way too bloated and there is a ton of waste. I mean, a perfect example is defense spending, because they've never passed an audit, you know, one time. Like, there's just like a lot of disorganization. I mean, if you were more cynical, you'd say corruption. A lot of waste going on in terms of the government spending. And obviously, the government spending is the root of a lot of these problems that Bitcoiners talk about, in terms of the deficits, debasement, and the continuing persistent inflation. And so they are getting down to like the root problem, which is reckless government spending. So, I mean, as a Bitcoiner, you have to kind of applaud the mission, and I do. Now, you know, whether how effective they will be is another question, because if you look at the government spending, like what we actually spend the money on, actually run the numbers, you'll find that 61% is mandatory programs like Social Security and Medicare. And another 16% is on, or 13% is on interest expense. All right. So we're looking at like 75% of the budget is like on interest expense, which Doge can't really control. That's interest rates in the Fed. And then mandatory programs, which any changes to the funding, the benefits, or the eligibility requirements, like the age requirements for Social Security, that has to go through Congress. So it's kind of outside Doge's control. And so while I support the mission and I think they will find waste, I mean, a perfect example was this large omnibus bill that it was like this big. And then after Doge just made noise about it, which I mean, they're kind of widening the Overton window, because they're just like, raising awareness about how wasteful the government spending has been. And so it was like this, and then it was like this big. And I thought that was kind of an interesting picture and comparison and how they could be effective here. But like some of the spending, like Elon had a space late last night about Doge, and they brought on this senator who I'd never heard speak before. I'm forgetting her name right now. But she said, like, you know, we all know some of the insane things that government spends money on, it they're laughable, right? Like, and she said two of them which stuck in my brain. There was like a study that the government paid for with taxpayer money of how shrimp can run on treadmills, you know. And there was another one with cats, you know, how much fur balls that cats cough up going to a spa. Like, I mean, just what? Completely ridiculous things. And So obviously, like, that was what the senator said, and I'm just believing her that those things are true because they're absolutely ridiculous. And so I support the mission, and we can get into the more the numbers of why I think they actually won't make a meaningful dent in the fiscal deficits. It's along the lines of what Lynn and I had recently wrote about fiscal dominance and nothing stops this train as a common meme, and love to get into some of that. You know, but some of these numbers that are getting thrown about by people, I would say including Elon, about like $2 trillion deficit, you know, spending being removed. And, you know, there's a lot of optimism around it. And I just like want to manage expectations a little bit. Yes, I support the mission to reduce government waste, and I think they will drive some positive change. But, you know, when you really dig into the numbers, I just don't see the fiscal deficits dropping anywhere, you know, anytime soon. And so that means inflation continues and, you know, good for Bitcoin, honestly. But yeah, I'll stop there.
So would you anticipate then at the end of a Trump presidency, even if Doge is quote unquote successful at removing, to your first point, some of the waste and corruption, would you anticipate deficits to, first of all, well, I think you've sort of framed that out, deficits to continue, but also U.S. federal debt to be higher than $36 trillion 4 years from now? Like, is that the nothing stops this train? Like, they simply can't, there isn't enough that they can cut readily without the political backlashes to make it impossible, like the Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, all those things.
Yeah, I mean, I would 100%. Like, I would think that the deficits will continue and that the debt's going to go higher.
Okay. Yeah.
People need to understand, like, a deficit, you know, there's two sides of the equation. There's the revenues we bring in through tax receipts, right? And then there's what we spend money on. And the difference is that we're spending more than we're bringing in with tax revenues. And that's the deficit. And that's why we have to continue to borrow money and add to the debt, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like people focus on the cuts to spending. But there's a couple things to consider. It's what's happening on the other side too. So when Trump talks about continuing the corporate tax cuts, for instance, and actually increasing those, like, I'm a pro-business guy, but, you know, objectively, that'll likely in the short term result in decreased tax revenues. And so that widens that gap on the other side of the equation, right? Less revenues coming in. And then, you know, the other thing that so you have to think about tax policy a little bit as well. And then now long term, I think that less taxes on corporations is a good thing because it leads to more reinvestment and economic growth. And that's a good way to bring up tax revenues, right? By just like growing the economy well. And so less money going to the government in general, I think is a good thing. But in the short term, I think there could be some pain and there would be less revenues coming in because it takes time for that to develop, right? For companies to reinvest and, you know, spur economic activity.
Do you have a gauge as to like what sort of, if something dramatic was done that might reduce, like, you know, lower taxes on businesses or, you know, abolition of the income tax, what is the lag for achieving some of that long-term growth that offsets the short-term pain and the widening of the deficit, perhaps?
Yeah, I don't really have a good... I don't know. Yeah. That'd be really difficult to measure.
Yeah.
I don't know what the
years,
lag
years, though, you think?
I would think years and probably multiple, you know, at least a couple administrations, like, right, four-year presidencies. It would take time for that to develop. You know, the next presidency would probably get a lot of credit for the economic growth that would be implemented from the tax policies of the prior administration, is typically how it goes. The other thing to consider, though, is that a lot of the economic activity, and this is the thesis of fiscal dominance, where economic activity is increasingly being driven by these large fiscal deficits. And if you cut the spending, try to reduce those deficits, what you'll see is a fall in asset prices. And the U.S. economy is highly financialized, meaning that tax receipts are deeply tied to asset prices. And to simplify it, it's simply, you know, capital gains tax. It's people feeling wealthier until they spend more in the economy because, you know, they see their portfolios rising. And And so a lot of the tax revenues are really deeply tied to the stock market and asset prices. And that's unique to the U.S. economy. And so if they cut spending, if Doge like miraculously was able to cut a lot of the spending, what happens is the asset prices would likely fall, and then you'd have a drop in asset the tax receipts. And so it kind of hurts the opposite edge of that equation, where any kind of cut in spending actually results in reduced tax revenues. And so the deficit remains. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It just moves with it nominally. Yeah.
Right. So the drop in tax revenues offsets any of the cuts to spending.
Got it.
And so that's another part of this equation that's really, you know, you have to think a little bit through it of why nothing stops this train. And so Canada, you know, in the past was able to cut spending a couple of decades ago, but they have a different tax base. You know, it's not as financialized. So they were able to successfully do it to implement austerity measures. And then there's Germany a couple of decades ago. They were able to successfully do it as well because their economy is like very manufacturer based, right? Their export economy. So they were able to like implement austerity measures and balance their budget. The U.S. is very financialized. And so if we do that, we'd have these dynamics where our tax revenues would really fall greatly with the cut spending. So that's a factor that people need to get in their heads. And, you know, I'd love to dig into the numbers a little bit more of why Doge likely won't make a dent in the fiscal deficits, because it really just comes down to math and the numbers.
Yeah. Let's talk about it. And to the extent that that ties into the work you've done with Lynn, I'd love to hear the, you know, all about fiscal dominance and why nothing stops this train. I think understanding some of the math behind it would be very helpful for people.
Yeah. So, I guess we'll kind of work backwards a little bit, but you know, basically the problem with inflation right now is driven by the fiscal policy side of things, where increase fiscal deficits, so multi-trillion dollar deficits, it is the main driver of economic activity and then, you know, inflationary pressures. And because of that, like the Fed raising interest rates or dropping interest rates, it actually doesn't do what it wants to do, which is to bring down inflation by raising interest rates. It actually just increases the interest expense on the giant mountain of debt, which widens the deficits more, which continue to drive the inflationary pressures. So it's like when we reach these periods where there's a huge debt burden, high debt to GDP ratios, the Fed's traditional monetary tools to bring down inflation no longer become effective and actually become counterproductive because they widen the deficits more because the interest expense increases. And in that period, you know, to address it, it really comes down to the fiscal side of things. So, you know, you have to go down to the root problem. And no matter what the Fed does over there, they're not going to actually be able to stabilize things without the government and the fiscal side getting their house in order and balancing their budget. And so, again, I applaud the mission of Doge because it actually gets down to the root problem. Now, why won't they make a dent? Well, last fiscal year, we spent $6.75 trillion. And 61% of that, as I mentioned, was mandatory spending. So it's these Social Security, Medicare. Now, those take an act of Congress, like I said, to change it. But if you actually take it further and look at the rest of what we spent money on, and I'll kind of go down and just like make sure I get these numbers right. So 13% was on net interest. So the Fed could change that by cutting interest rates. But again, that's outside the purview of like Doge, what Doge can do. The Doge can't tell the Fed what to do in terms of the interest rate policy. Okay. And so then there's about 26% of what we spent on is discretionary spending. Okay. So that's actually something where Doge could go in and maybe start cutting some things. And so still we're kind of working with basically a fourth of the spending budget. But even if you go into the discretionary spending, half of that was defense spending. And so defense spending, obviously, when you look out onto the world, it's very heightened geopolitical tensions. And so I just personally really doubt that they're going to get away with, doing any kind of defense spending or cuts. It's just, it doesn't seem politically attainable right now. And also you just look out the world and like, got to stay competitive. You know, geopolitics kind of takes precedent in times that are becoming increasingly uncertain. And so I don't see half of that discretionary spending really getting touched. And if you look at the CBO's projections, they expect the defense spending to increase. Furthermore, if you look at the GOP platform, there's two things. One is they promised not to cut Medicare or Social Security, and President Trump said that multiple times. And so that 61%, they promised not to touch it. The other promise they made was that they want to strengthen and modernize our military, which sounds expensive. And so, again, I don't think that discretionary part, the defense spending part, is going to really be touched. Now, they might find some waste because, as I said, the defense never passed an audit, but that's not going to be a majority of that. So I just don't see that getting touched that much. Now, that leaves 14% of the spending that is non-defense discretionary spending, which is the prime target DOGE, which is only $948 billion of the $6.75 trillion that we spent. And so well below Elon's projections of $2 trillion. Realistically, only $948 billion can be cut. And even if they did cut, you know, every single federal worker, I estimated that they would save only $200 billion a year. And so this is what we mean when we say that, you know, the spending is structural. So you hear that a lot. Why it's structural, why people say that, is federal deficits, fiscal deficits are typically, we're supposed to be countercyclical in nature, meaning when there's a recessionary period, the government would ramp up spending to kind of pull us out of the recession. And then once economic growth starts to increase, they would basically tighten the budget and run surpluses and balance the budget so that during the next recession, we would be able to do the same thing without blowing out the budget. Now, over the last multiple decades or so, we've run deficits even in good times. And a perfect example is lately, where the unemployment rate is near historic lows, economic growth is good, above normal, and we're still running multi-trillion dollar deficits. Well, why? And it's because we don't really have a choice. And it's because the deficits are related to aging demographics, rising healthcare costs, and then compounding interest expense on decades and decades of accumulated debt. And so, you know, those are, every single year, there's more Americans that are becoming eligible for Medicare and Social Security and these entitlement programs. And they were promised, they paid into them. And that's just going to continue as our population continues to age. And so that's why these structural deficits, like if you look at the CBO's projections, 87% of the spending increases over the next decade come from mandatory programs, Medicare, Social Security, and interest expense. Okay. So that's what people mean when they say it's structural in nature. And that's why, like, DOGE can really attack only a tiny sliver of the spending. And if we don't meaningfully change the entitlement programs through some piece of legislation, or somehow untangle our tax policy with asset prices, or both, we kind of need both. I don't see how these fiscal deficits won't continue. And because the fiscal deficits will continue, and they're the main driver of economic activity today and inflation, then what we expect is that just continually hot economy, continually hot inflation reads. And that's like that's fiscal dominance.
Yeah. So hypothetical of all hypotheticals, if you had complete control of Congress, if you could sign executive orders on behalf of the executive branch, if you could control the Federal Reserve and you were Secretary of the Treasury, what is it that you would do? And then maybe juxtapose that with, what do you think, what's the likely outcome, which I suspect we both sort of know. But like, if someone with your mindset, your recognition of the problem, had all of the authority you needed to resolve this best you could, what would that solution look like?
Well, look, I'm a humble Bitcoiner. You know, I don't pretend to be some kind of expert in policy or, you know, but if it was me, look, you have to change the entitlement programs. I mean, to make any kind of meaningful dent in the spending. I talked about how 87% of the spending is really coming from those entitlement programs plus interest expense over the next decade. And, you know, ideally what you'd want is growth, like real economic growth, like a productivity miracle to help grow our way out of this. That's the best case scenario. And, you know, one of the things of any kind of nation is you have to support young people. Like you have to, you know, make sure that they understand that if they're buying into some kind of entitlement program, that they're going to see the fruits of that labor. Like right now, I mean, it's really fair to say that the way the math works out, that Social Security is kind of like a Ponzi scheme. Like a young person isn't going to see really a cent of it. It's just because of how the math's set up. And so I would do some kind of policies that, you know, support young people and reduce entitlements for the older people. And I think you just kind of have to. And it's going to be very politically charged. But in terms of making any kind of meaningful debt, that's important. Now, I think what the DOGE is doing in terms of trying to find waste, like the audit, the fact that the defense never spent passed an audit, I think there's a lot of wasteful spending throughout the government. So I would do some of that for sure. Now, in terms of productivity, what's interesting is, you know, you can do productivity really comes down to two things. It's the size of the labor force, and then it's the productivity of the labor force. So the quantity and the quality of the labor force. Productivity is just a measure of how much GDP somebody produces per person, so to speak. And, you know, when you look at the labor force size, this is why the math doesn't work out with these entitlement programs, because back in whatever, when they were kind of implemented, I think in the 60s, they got two things wrong, which is one, we're living longer than we used to. And then two, they didn't expect the birth rates to plummet, which, you know, I think both of us would say money is part of the equation there, broken money. Yes. Now, that's why the math doesn't work out. If you look at the ratio of active workers versus retiring workers, or, you know, older generations versus active workforce, that continues to decline. And so we have a shrinking labor force and larger retirement, you know, population or demographic that has to support them.
Right, right.
And so that's why, like, you know, immigration policy is one way you can expand the size of the labor force, but we're seeing the opposite of that, right? We're seeing more protectionism. And so what we got to do is we got to get more out of the labor force that we have. We got to increase the productivity. Now, how do you do that? That comes down to education. So making them more skilled. And I look at AI, and it's one of the reasons why I'm kind of bullish on AI from a productivity standpoint, because if you can have a very patient tutor available 24/7, you know, that could really boost the education of the labor force, make them more skilled, and boost the productivity. So that's great. That's just one example. So that's one way to do it. And there's also capital investment. So getting better tools for your workforce. You know, it could be something like an ergonomic vacuum for people on a conveyor belt so that they don't get hurt as much. And, you know, that's a way to like increase productivity. So capital investment. And then the other thing is innovation. And innovation is the number one driver of productivity. And it's kind of related to capital investment. And it's so important to be pro-business, because most innovation and innovative breakthroughs happen from small businesses, from startups. And, you know, when I think out at the world, like what I would do from a policy standpoint is just support businesses, small businesses, as well as make it easier for access to capital in different ways so that they can get the funding they need. So reduce deregulation, reduce some of the red tape. And then hopefully that drives innovation, which drives productivity. And I think Bitcoin is one of these technologies that actually will drive productivity because it allows people to save. And so we can get into that because it's like a different concept. But I'll stop there because that's, you know, I would change the entitlement programs, make policies that support the young people more, because I think the pendulum shifted too far, I would try to find government waste where I could and reduce it. And then I would deregulate and try to boost productivity in different ways.
Yeah.
To grow our way out of it.
Seems like there's an appetite for some of what you said, right? I mean, and you know, I'm always skeptical of politicians, but I think to Trump's credit so far, he's signing some, what seemed to me at least, to be productive executive orders. But I think at the end of the day, the important thing you hit on there is entitlement programs. I mean, I don't think there's any political willpower to like really do the work that needs to be done, because the pain on a large voting block would be massive. And I think the challenge is, my dad's 67 years old. So he, you know, if he lives to be, you know, for 20 more years, we have this problem of, and so it's not to single out like a generation or certainly individuals, but we have the problem of boomers are going to be around for a while collecting, while, to your point, an ever decreasing pool of workers are funding that. And it's, I don't feel like we have a 20-year runway to get through this large aging population. And again, I don't have the data probably that you have to support that statement, except it seems unfeasible to me. Sam, we can dig into anything around this that you want. Otherwise, I mean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the other things that maybe affect Bitcoin more directly.
Yeah, you
know, sure. SAB 121, FASB, but is there anything you wanted to touch on that maybe
last
we didn't
thing
get
I'll
to
just
there?
Say, maybe I mentioned it just briefly, is just like the productivity of Bitcoin is. The reason is like, if I've studied like productivity, and because like you're right, and some of the things you just said, but if we could somehow make that labor force more productive, then we'll be fine. You know, we'll have a really high growth economy that creates a lot of abundance for people. Now, and I said that innovation kind of drives productivity. If you look at the long-term productivity growth, it's around 2.1%. But, you know, you would think like the internet, right? Like that should have boosted productivity substantially, right? You would think so. There's like a, you know, we have the World Wide Web, communications, mini computer in our pocket that has all these things. But there's a famous saying from this economist called Robert Salo that said, the computer age is everywhere, but not in the productivity statistics. Because from 2000, it spiked briefly around 2000 in terms of like over 3%. And then from 2009 to like 2019, productivity was like 0.8%. So well below 2.1%. Now, this is when it gets down to Jeff Booth's thesis, because it's like, was the productivity there or was it just stolen for the majority of people?
Mm.
Right? It's because of the debasement of the currency, people's being unable to save. And if people are able to save, it's actually, I think, one of the main drivers of productivity, because when individuals and businesses can save, they start to think long term, and the fruits of their labor is not debased. And so then they start to say, like, you know, I have this crazy idea. Like, it's crazy. I got this invention. I don't know. Maybe I'll explore it, because like my savings are actually appreciating over time. And I have a deflationary money that is allowing the productivity of society to be shared. And that's how you get like real innovative breakthroughs, is people's ability to save. And so it's kind of like a precursor to more capital investment, which leads to more investment. Are more innovation, and then that kind of can spur a productivity boom. And so I think Bitcoin is just one of these technologies that could be paired with, say, nuclear fission and fusion AI, that could help us potentially grow our way out of this program, this problem, this debt problem, which would be the best scenario. So a little bit optimistic, but that's why I say that Bitcoin could potentially be a part of this productivity miracle.
Yeah. In other words, people are sitting on the hamster wheel, just trying to keep up with, you know, with life and expenses and, you know, just live their day to day. If they had the ability to hop off because of hard savings that they could fall back on and do some of these things that you're talking about.
Yeah. Start that business, build that invention, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, so let's talk about before we get to some of these other sort of big but smaller items. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, and that's the U.S. digital asset reserve. Because I'm curious to what extent you think, I'll just give you my opinion, and I think it's probably sort of a contrarian take. It's just a real small government guy, or is an ideally almost no government guy. I tend to be wary of government, you know, certainly printing a bunch of money to buy Bitcoin and reducing individuals' ability to accumulate. But it also concerns me just more government power. I think Bitcoin's finite supply over the long term leads to reduced power by governments, even if they accumulate it, because they can't print more of it. But in the short term, I could see it giving the governments who stack sooner, you know, a lot of sway in geopolitical events. What's your take on, so it was all a lot to say not much, I guess, but what's your overall take on the, we're calling it the digital asset reserve, I guess, because that's sort of how it's been framed in the executive order. What do you think comes of that? What's your opinion on what that should look like, if there should be one, and how you think that impacts maybe some of the things we've talked about up to now?
Yeah, I think, I just think about like incentives and the game theory of Bitcoin, like when it comes down to it, and that every single institution will benefit from Bitcoin. And so it's natural for governments, banks, institutions, individuals to all be attracted to this superior reserve asset, superior form of money. I mean, and so I kind of think of it, it's inevitable, and we already have El Salvador doing it. But there's a game theory at play here. Like if the United States doesn't do it, I think there's likely to be other countries that do it, especially with the increased, you know, trade wars, the tariffs, trade restrictions, the seizure of treasury reserves that the United States did to Russia. There's been this huge movement from governments and central banks to diversify their reserves to gold. But as we know, that Bitcoin has some superior properties to gold and is also neutral in a political and censorship resistance, which is really attractive to these other countries. So I think it's kind of a natural development on the Bitcoin adoption path or cycle, so to speak. And so that's how I first started to think about it. And then, you know, in terms of what it should look like, right now it's like a stockpile, which they're just taking the existing Bitcoin that they've seized through various enforcement actions and just kind of saying, like, we're going to hold on to it. We won't sell it. And then there's like Cynthia Lummis's, which is the Bitcoin Reserve Act or Strategic Reserve Act. And they're kind of figuring out ways to actually buy Bitcoin, right? Which is a little bit different. And so Trump kind of, the executive order creates a working group that'll explore the possibilities of creating a digital reserve stockpile. And so the wording is kind of important. You know, what it should look like. Like I focus primarily on Bitcoin. By primarily, I mean like only. And you know, there's a lot of hoopla around digital assets and not saying Bitcoin. And I get it. You know, only Bitcoin is, I think, considered decentralized and actually leaderless and had a fair launch. Fair distribution, and it's actually scarce. There'll only be 21 million. I think it's digital commodity money, and so I do think it only makes sense for it to be Bitcoin. Now, the reason why I think maybe we all want to shrink the government is that I would say the government's the worst allocator of capital. So I don't think we should be surprised if they make the mistake to go down the route of having other digital assets in there. The beauty of it is that Bitcoin has certain monetary properties where everything trends to zero against it. And even if a sliver of this, you know, stockpile might be in other digital assets, over time, Bitcoin will just make up a greater and greater percentage of it as it appreciates versus them because of its monetary properties. So in the long run, it'll be a 99.9% stockpile no matter what. But so, that's kind of how I view it. I know there's a lot of anger about that, but I just think more long term, and you know, I generally see it as a positive development. and kind of a natural development.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. It's inevitable. I think my hope is, as much as I think we'd all like our bags to be pumped, my hope would be more friends and family, individuals, small businesses, they get to the party before the federal government does. But it's not looking
chance,
that,
do you,
yeah,
know?
Yeah, no, I know. It's not, that's the sad thing. It's not looking that way. Like all this news, and I still am not getting text messages from people asking, explain this thing to me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, people just had to open a book, read an article or two, and make the decision themselves.
Unfortunately, they were all reading the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times for too long instead of the Bitcoin Standard or something
useful.
Yeah,
and a lot of people, unfortunately, they need that stamp of approval. That they wait for, you know, government to tell them what's right and what's wrong, which I thoroughly, you know, hope people rethink that. But they need that. And so they'll wait for the government to do it. Then they'll say, okay, I can, you know, it's safe for me to buy some Bitcoin. Yeah. That's just how it is.
Yeah, no, you're right. Well, government approval, speaking of, let's talk a little bit about SAB 121. Why don't you explain what it is? And it was repealed, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So what?
SAB 122.
122, there you go. So what does it mean for banks, for Bitcoin? I assume it's, you know, it's bullish. It gives that permission I think some people are looking for.
Yeah, so SAB 121 was a rule slapped down by the SEC. It was basically an accounting rule that made it prohibitively expensive for banks to custody Bitcoin on behalf of their clients. And so it basically treated Bitcoin very differently than every other asset class, where if a bank had to hold it, it had to treat it as both an asset and a liability on its balance sheet, even though they just held it on behalf of their clients, which means they basically had to allocate like a certain amount of reserves to back it up. So like it made it very expensive for them to do it, which was basically like an effective ban, prohibited them. Mm-hmm. It's like it made no sense to them to do it economically. And so this was fought, you know, because it made no sense, right? I mean, the SEC brought it down because they said, you know, we're trying to protect consumers and, protect the traditional banking system from like intertwining with digital assets too much, and so that it wouldn't make it financially like unstable. But what it really did was push a lot of these clients into like the FTXs of the world. And so like very unregulated institutions, which really hurt people. And so they almost like contradicted themselves when they did that. So the rule didn't make sense. It was, you know, went through Congress that it should be repealed. And then Joe Biden vetoed it. So it was bipartisan that the rule should be appealed last year. And then Joe Biden vetoed it, which is wild. And it was either even like the American Banking Association and Bank Policy Institute, these lobbying groups wrote letters to Joe Biden saying like, hey, we think we want to be able to service our customers and be able to provide them with safe, highly regulated custody options. And it would actually be safer for you to repeal this rule and not veto it. But he didn't listen to them either. And so there's a lot of uproar about it, basically. And then, you know, one of the first things that the SEC has done since is rescind that rule. And so, it's a positive development because now these banks can basically provide services for their clients on behalf of their clients. So they can custody it. They can, do maybe lending products and do different things. And so it kind of will just kind of drive adoption further, provide more financial services for Bitcoiners from these institutions. And like, you know, for example, like you and I both, this is a different spectrum of custody options. And like, personally, I like to hold my own keys. I think not having counterparty risk and using Bitcoin in a sovereign way, that's personally very attractive to me. Now there's certain institutions as well as investors that might not feel comfortable with that. So I think there's a huge spectrum of custody options that should be available to people with different trade-offs and risks. And as long as people understand those risks that they're taking, and I don't really see that much of a problem with it. I guess I'm a free market maximalist for custody solutions as well. Personally, I like to hold my own keys, and I think most people should look into that. But these banks, you know, BNY Mellon, State Street, these are some of the oldest institutions in the world. They were building out Bitcoin custody platforms for years. And then State Street just had to close up shop because of these random rules that were placed, discriminatory rules against Bitcoin. They had to shut down their entire platform, lay off a bunch of their workforce that was working on it. BNY Mellon, to their credit, that continued to build despite that. And then they were finally able to do it. So like last year, like the SEC just randomly like allowed them to bypass the rule for some reason, but now it doesn't matter because they rescinded it. But BNY Mellon can now offer these services, and it's like another very respected custody solution that people can use if they want to, especially like financial advisors and things where they're kind of restricted from regulations from holding their own, your client's private keys or something like that. And so you just think about what adoption would have been like if we didn't have that rule. It would have been accelerated probably. Now, I will say that there's kind of other factors to consider here, and it's that the SEC is not the only regulator of the banks. They had this accounting rule, which now makes it better for them to, more economically favorable for them to custody Bitcoin on behalf of their clients. But there's still the OCC, the FDIC, and the Fed that are all regulators as well. Now, the Fed put down a crypto policy statement last year, 2 years ago, prohibits state chartered banks from holding Bitcoin on their own balance sheets on principle. So like a big bank couldn't set up a treasury reserve strategy right now for itself. And that probably limits them to setting up solution, like payment solutions using Bitcoin rails or something like that, or like Lightning. Like they couldn't set up any kind of products or services like that as it stands today because of the Fed, not the SEC. Mm. And then the OCC and the FDIC have been blocking banks for a long time and Bitcoin companies from working with banks to develop different products and services. We know this because Coinbase's lawsuit just released 25 FDIC letters. You can read them yourselves. Banks were thinking about developing debit reward cards, like Fold, but they were thinking about doing that. They were thinking about doing lending. They were thinking about having buy and hold and withdrawals in the bank's platforms themselves. All of that was stopped because of the FDIC. And it wasn't like an outright ban, but it was like, if you're a bank, and your regulator says like, hey, we really don't want you to do this, or, you know, we're going to be angry with you. Like, you don't want to tick off your regulator, your bank.
Right. So
they'll like make your life a living hell. And so it was like effective ban because it was the reputational risk and the regulatory risk, which was like tacitly implied by these regulators, was there, and it prevented these banks from developing those products. So we need some of those other regulators to get on board. And I think that is happening through external pressures from the changing administration, as well as a change of leadership. And, to kind of fully open the door. But SAB 121 is just one piece of the puzzle that now is gone. So kind of a thorough overview there, but that's how I see it.
I think that's helpful. So do you think over the next year, couple of years, we're going to see a lot more of these offer? Like, is your sense that banks are itching to get into the game? Because it sounds like there are a few who were starting to build, and they were doing so well in advance of it really being possible. But now maybe that the floodgates open. Like at the end of 2025, is your anticipation several notable banks, maybe even some smaller mid-sized banks, are now doing a lot of the things that they just simply couldn't? Or is it going to take a long time for them to build these solutions, you think?
I think the bigger banks will be faster because they have more resources, and especially with technology, than smaller banks. But yes, like hands down, like you see it from those interviews from Davos. It was basically every single major bank CEO was asked about Bitcoin in Davos, which kind of speaks to how Bitcoin has just grown up. No, it's like the topic of conversation. But they all said the same thing, which is like, this was before SAB 121 rescinded, like maybe earlier that week. They were just saying like, hey, we're just waiting for you know, approval to be able to work with this thing in a way that is, you know, economically makes sense and reduce regulatory or more regulatory clarity. That's, and then they, I think the CEO of Bank of America said banks are going to come in a big way. That's what he said in those quote. And so I think we're going to see that for sure. And I think now that SAB 121 is reversed, and even the executive order that you talked about with the stockpile, there was other things that were really great in it too. Like there was language that was more, after talking to Joe Carlisari, it was more aspirational language, but I think it was a great sign. The language protected the right to self-custody. It protected the right to mine. It protected the right to develop open source code. So that was great. It also protected or prevented discriminatory access to banking services. So some of the stuff that we talked about. So that was a part of it. Banned central bank digital currency, central bank digital currencies. That was great. And as well as created that working group that will explore the stockpile. So I think all those things, now that banks, Bitcoin companies will be able to access banking services, as well as banks on the other side wanting to develop services, will really accelerate Bitcoin adoption.
Yeah. Do you think one thing that I've felt is that if we can just have, if even even if like a strategic reserve doesn't happen, but right, like a lot of the regulatory, like the operation choke point, those sorts of things just disappear for 4 years, that might be enough time to get us escape velocity on some of these things. Like once that genie's out of the bottle 4 years from now, it's just, it's not going to be possible. Like I think if we'd had a Harris administration, and I've got my issues with Trump too, but like, I think if we'd had a Harris administration, my feeling is that we would have just kind of kept trudging along. And this might be the window of time to build and grow to where 4 years from now, we get a new administration that doesn't like this stuff. It just doesn't matter anymore. Like it's too late, and it's maybe taken on sort of a whole new life within banking, within institutional adoption. Is that sort of the sense that you have, or am I maybe being a bit optimistic about what could, you know, the turning of a new administration a few years from now?
No, I think just what it comes down to is just, I think Bitcoin is superior technology first off. And I think that once the banks allocate the resources and the time to develop products and services, then there's no going back. That just moves in one direction, no matter what the administration is. So I think, you know, as these things develop, I mean, kudos to the industry for growing as much as it did with all those barriers in place. So you just imagine what it's like to have those barriers down. And so I think that genie's out of the bottle. You know, it's really not going to go back in, no matter what the administration does, because what the banks will find is that they can make a ton of money off Bitcoiners and providing Bitcoin services. And like the world wants Bitcoin. Everyone wants Bitcoin. And, you know, and then they're going to just spend a lot of time and resources building out these custody solutions. There'll be acquisitions of Bitcoin companies from these big banks. And, you know, that genie's out of the bottle. Once they remove these rules, regulators, maybe there's some kind of piece of legislation, and the regulators finally allow the full entrenchment of Bitcoin into the traditional financial system, which it's still not fully entrenched. You know, that's never going back.
Yeah, I think you're right. Hey, let's talk about a company that's been bucking traditional financial norms for a little while now, MicroStrategy. So this is one that, like, you know this about me, I'm not a financial guy. So like I'm reading a lot, I'm learning as much as I can. MicroStrategy just released an additional new offering, Series A perpetual preferred stock, called Strike. Could you maybe, I mean, just very, very briefly kind of lay out what it is MicroStrategy is doing, what this, I assume you've looked into Strike a little bit, or you probably at least understand the fundamentals of it.
Yeah. No, it's kind of your world. You know, at this point, there's groups of individuals who only focus on MicroStrategy. But, you know, I do follow it relatively closely, I guess. But, you know, I just think what Michael Saylor is doing and what he's talked about a lot is he's basically delivering Bitcoin in securities or investment vehicles that other investors can want and need to gain access to exposure to Bitcoin, to exposure to Bitcoin. And so there's some investors out there that literally can only invest in bonds because of their investment mandates or equities. And there's people out there who simply can't invest in Bitcoin because of its volatility for different reasons. Like it doesn't fit into their VAR models, or it's just too risky. Maybe they just think that's risky and they just don't have the stomach for it. And so what he's taking, and he's called this like a transformer, or he's transforming raw Bitcoin into different forms of Bitcoin in different securities. So like MicroStrategy stock is like 2x the volatility of Bitcoin. So some people want that. Some people want more volatility. And so that's why they get like a leveraged micro. If they want leveraged Bitcoin, they can buy some MicroStrategy stock. Now there's some bond investors that want some downside protection. They want the convertible debt. Maybe they can only buy convertible debt. Maybe they're convertible debt traders that can only trade these things. You know, like the volatility of Bitcoin is like an asset that Michael Saylor is delivering to them, because these bonds, the way options work, the way the convertible debt math works, the more volatile the underlying asset, the more valuable these options can become. And so MicroStrategy's convertible debts offering that they've, over the last year, it's been the best performing convertible bonds on the market, and they've actually outperformed Bitcoin because they've become so popular. And it's like Bitcoin with a little bit of, you know, a call option to basically convert it to common stock in the future, say at like a certain date, like in 2029, 2030. You have the bond, which, I mean, it's basically downside protection, because you always have that principal back that you invested in the bond. But in the future, you can convert it to the underlying stock. So it's almost like this like downside protected exposure to MicroStrategy stock. Now, the preferred stock that he just offered is a little bit unique, and it's just kind of like another vehicle. And so the problem with convertible debt is like not a lot of regular investors can get convertible debt. Like it's like you can't just go buy convertible bonds. It's usually like institutions or, you know, a regular retail investor can't get exposure to that downside protection vehicle. And so what his new strike product is basically like a combination of the two. And it's also accessible to the regular retail investor because it's just another stock ticker. It's this STRK, I think. And so what that is it pays a dividend like a bond. So like 8% dividend, which is like a comparable to like a high yield debt instrument, high yield bond. And so pays 8%. It's perpetual, meaning you can always like convert it to the common, which is different than the convertible debt, because like I said, that usually goes out to like a certain date, like 2030, 2031, 2032. But if you have a really like decades and decades long view, if you're like a more of a long-term investor and believer in Bitcoin, you don't really want that. You just want like unlimited exposure. So that's a little bit of a difference too between the convertible debt instruments and this new preferred. It's unlimited and it's 8%. And then it's a little bit less volatile than the regular common stock. So if somebody wants a more exposure to Bitcoin, but they want less volatility than the MicroStrategy stock and Bitcoin, and they want a dividend, so they want like a little bit of income every year, and they're really long-term investors, so they don't, unlike the convertible debt, doesn't have a cap, then this would be a really attractive product for them. And so this is just another example of Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy taking raw Bitcoin and creating a new financial instrument that is has unique properties that could be attractive to certain investors for what they need and want. And so, you know, he's called them, like he's made the analogy of like an oil company, right? Taking raw oil, crude oil, and then making like gasoline, because it provides different use and utility. And there's reasons why people would want the gasoline and not just the crude oil. And so that's the best way.
It makes a lot of sense, you know, and I think like something as someone who, you know, didn't study finance, like I've begun to learn and appreciate is that there's a big difference between what an investor particularly institutionally, might desire versus what mandate they have. And it seems like he's offering like a pretty broad menu at this point that, that would enable almost anyone.
Yeah. There are Bitcoin-backed securities. So it's a broad menu of getting exposure to Bitcoin, and investors need different things. Talking institutional investors.
But at the end of the day, though, you have to have a bullish base case for Bitcoin to be interested in these products, because you're not looking at MicroStrategy, the software company, probably, and saying, we're going up 10x.
Yeah, they're
from
a Bitcoin treasury company. You know, that's what he says, and that's what they are. And so you are just getting, you have to be bullish on Bitcoin. There's no really reason to not be, to own these things if you don't. Now, the other thing I'll say is that I didn't mention, just like a really other thing, is that like there's something called a capital stack, or like any kind of company, like the seniority in the capital stack. And what that means is like when, if a company goes bankrupt, the bondholders gets paid out before the shareholders, so the equity holders. And so that's why another reason why bonds are considered safer. So if the company gets into trouble and they have to, you know, go bankrupt, bondholders get paid first, and then the stockholders get everything else. So in a way, you can have equity holders completely wiped out and the bondholders get all their money back, or at least part of their money back, if that makes sense. So they have seniority in the capital stack. And so in the way this works, like it goes convertible debt holders, preferred stockholders, regular MicroStrategy stockholders. And so if anything happened to MicroStrategies, which is, you know, there's still counterparty risk there. That's just another reason why it might be attractive to an investor that I didn't mention.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. All right. I've got one last topic for you I'd love to cover. We should have talked about this earlier on when we were sort of tangential to it. The repeal of the income tax, the introduction of tariffs. So just in the last couple of, maybe 2 days ago, I think the Trump administration slapped 25% tariffs on most goods in Canada, Mexico, I think China as well. I don't know if it was 25% across the board, but high tariffs. And he's talked about repealing the income tax. It seems to me like you can't have, I'd love to get your thoughts on the implications of one and both of those, and how maybe both of them together would affect things. I know tariffs seem to me to be inflationary. They're going to drive prices up, reduce competition in the United States. I've wondered though, but if you countered that with people have more money in their pockets from the repeal of the income tax, does that sort of offset? I know the problem is 50% or whatever if people don't pay income taxes, and so they're not benefiting from income taxes being reduced or eliminated. They're just paying higher prices on their goods. First of all, am I sort of getting that right? And then I want your opinion on, you know, what do you think is happening here? How does this play out?
Yeah, there's a lot of debate right now about tariffs, whether they're inflationary or not. And, you know, personally, I just like, I feel like I need to like research it a little bit more to speak that intelligently on it. You know, I kind of lean towards what you just said. It kind of makes sense on the face to me that it would be inflationary, as domestic producers have increased prices on the imports because they have to kind of import raw materials and other things. And, you know, supply chains are a little different than in the past. They're much more integrated and global. They were kind of simple back in the day when people reference tariffs and how we didn't have an income tax and it led to all this. You know, it's kind of simple. Like we made stuff domestically and then imported like finished goods. Whereas now everything's so connected and it's very, a lot more complex. And so like eliminating the income tax, you know, it goes back to like what I said with like the fiscal deficits. It's like, yeah, okay, you reduce the tax revenues though. You know, remember, it's like half of the equation of these deficits. And you better, like those tariffs better fill that void. I don't believe in the income tax. I don't like taxes in general. I think people should have more money in their pockets and businesses should have more money in their pockets. And so I also said, like, if we're going to fix the deficit problem, we have to somehow untangle the Gordian knot of tax policy and asset price inflation. And so if like this crazy idea somehow works, it's interesting. Now, what could happen, though, is there's like retaliation. What we're seeing right now from Canada is a perfect example, where they slap on a tariff of their own. And this is kind of what we saw back in the 1930s when there was a tariff legislation passed, where we saw a lot of retaliation of tariffs from trading partners, and global trade dropped 60%. And, you know, that's the concern, is that you tick everybody off and then there's just slowing economic growth because all the supply chains are not moving as efficiently. People are distrusting of one another, slapping tariffs on everything, like it impedes free trade, right? You want these things to run very freely. That's so they get cheap goods. Like one of the things people don't understand is that from the last 30 years, underappreciate the deglobalization and the cheap labor, access to cheap labor and access to cheap goods from deglobalization. And there was a free flowing supply chains. And that was the unipolar world, United States. And now we're moving into a multipolar world. And that's inflationary. If we're moving into a multipolar world where there's more trade restrictions and animosity between trading partners, if one was very deflationary, then this one's probably inflationary. Reshoring the supply chains, reshoring the manufacturing, that all has a cost, and it's inflationary. And if you even look at the trade restrictions since 2019, BlackRock had a good chart. It showed that the trade restrictions have tripled since 2019, from like 1,000 to 3,000 around the globe. And that's not good. I mean, that's just like, it just impedes the free flow of everything. And then if you're thinking about currencies and you're thinking about like government currencies and then being weaponized and having currency wars, then yeah, I would say an apolitical one is going to become a lot more popular in that world. That's censorship resistant. And so I saw, and this is more big picture, right? Like, I don't know if the tariffs are going to work and that's going to bring in the taxes and if they're in, you know, but I do know that like more animosity and more weaponization of government controlled money is going to lead to countries all around the world and individuals all around the world being attracted to a non-government alternative money. And it's a, you know, that's, it, I saw a little blurb in the Wall Street Journal. It said, cross-border trade war hits borderless Bitcoin. That was really interesting because it's like, it highlights the short-term volatility and maybe the, you know, the wrong reaction, I would say, from this, because in the long term, the borderless trade of Bitcoin, this is extremely, I think, beneficial to Bitcoin, a trade war or more trade restrictions.
Yeah, that lack of friction that Bitcoin offers is, I think, very underappreciated. No exchange rates, you know, sanction-free, censorship-resistant, because I'm reading the book Currency Wars right now.
And
to the extent that there's an equivalent on trade wars, I would be very curious to read something like that, because so many of these, like, it's like I sort of fundamentally, obviously I wouldn't be a Bitcoiner if I didn't fundamentally understand many of the problems that it fixes, but it just opens your eyes to these new things. And I think the trade wars are a big one, but it's this, everything we're talking about is so multifaceted, and we are talking thousands of variables that all play into these things. And each time you kind of unpack a new one, it's like, well, yeah, Bitcoin doesn't have that yeah, problem.
Exactly. And it's I think that is a great book. It's very before its time too. And, you know, that guy's kind of like a Bitcoin bear, but I do respect his knowledge about some of these things. And I appreciate the fact that he called a lot of this. I think that book was written in like 2009 or something.
I think it was like 11, because it was, yeah, I think it's just after the kind of coming out of the financial crisis.
Yeah. And one thing really stuck with me from that book is it was kind of sobering, but I think it was trade wars lead to currency wars, lead to real wars. And, you know, maybe Bitcoin can prevent us from going down that route, because now there's an alternative that's apolitical, that's borderless, that people can turn to. But I do think he's right about that. You know, I think it's like a precursor. It's a form of war to weaponize currencies against your trading partners and to basically force policy through that weaponization. And it's something that's been leaned on more and more. So, Yeah, I recommend people read that book. I really like that book. Thought it was a very prescient of what was about to happen, and it's still useful to read today. So,
yeah, I hadn't looked into the author. I don't know. I didn't know his opinion on Bitcoin.
He's a big gold bug. Big gold bug, big anti-Bitcoin guy. But like again, I respect different viewpoints. And
it's just funny, like. The gold bugs, I think it has a lot more to do with ego than it has to do with anything fundamental. And like, I kind of sympathize, like if you've been pounding the drum on sound money for 50 years, 30 years, whatever, to like your lead racehorse suddenly no longer being the best and the fastest, you really got to swallow your pride. But there's no reason anyone who reads that book and it makes sense, or certainly someone who writes that book, shouldn't be a Bitcoiner. Like,
I don't know what his holdup is, but yeah, man, I always thought he'd be understood the value proposition a little bit, but
maybe he hasn't read enough about it.
I've followed him along because, like I said, I like that book, and but yeah, unfortunately, not yet. Everyone gets Bitcoin at the price they deserve.
That's right. All right, man. Hey, we're past an hour, so let me just ask you one more question. And this is one I ask everyone. What is an unpopular opinion that you hold, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it?
Oh, man. I don't know. Like, maybe it might be, you know, what I said earlier about the spectrum of custody solutions and just how I think all of it's kind of accretive to Bitcoin's adoption. As long as the risks are clearly explained,
yeah,
and education's right. I mean, I think some facets of Bitcoiners would maybe disagree with me on that. But I just think like all of these things in terms of nation state adoption, government adoption, as long as Bitcoin's incentives are right, and that no matter how large or powerful or politically connected an institution or a group of individuals is, that they can't change the protocol or manipulate it, then it's all good. Like, I'm not going to like scream against BlackRock getting into Bitcoin or issuing an ETF or a government, because to me, it's just natural. And so, yes, I think we're all in the stage of like, we were here when Bitcoin was growing up and we believe in self-custody. And I think as long as that's protected and accessible to anybody who wants it, I think that's a great thing. And I think it needs to be preserved. Absolutely. For not just freedom, but also the health of the network. But that's maybe a thing that maybe some Bitcoiners would disagree with me on. But yeah. I think it's a natural growth of Bitcoin as a technology, that it's kind of inevitable.
What I'll say to that, you know that myself and I mean, you heard me talk on self-custody and, you know, the Bitcoin ways position, and like, we're very dogmatic. But at the same time, I think here's the important point you touched on there, and what is vastly misunderstood, and that is, what are the risks of doing any sort of custody solution?
Totally.
And, you know, I think a lot of people are in the ETFs, for example, or, you know, leaving their keys on an exchange, and they simply, it hasn't really been solidified in their minds what that means. And like, maybe it's a risk that they're willing to take, but I don't think it's been well thought out by most people.
Yeah.
And so the important thing is really just that understanding of risk.
Yeah, I think
if you're willing to take on risk that I'm not going to, I mean, so be it. If you lose your stack though, because you did that, I hope it was done with, you know, informed consent on the front end, you know?
Yeah. And if the risks weren't properly disclosed, then that's kind of, you know, yeah. And I totally understand. I'm like preaching. It's just like, maybe we disagree on that, but it's okay. And it's like this thing, like everything's good for Bitcoin. It's kind of like, it's kind of a funny mantra, but it's something that I've really found to be kind of true over the years.
Yeah, makes sense, man. Well, hey, Sam, we cover a lot of ground, man. I really appreciate you taking some time. Good chatting with you again. And looking forward to this one coming out in a few weeks. I think these are just a lot of things people have questions on, are looking for answers to, and none better than you to kind of walk everyone through it. So thank you for your time. Why don't you give a handoff and tell people where they can find you?
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for all the work you're doing at the Bitcoin Way. I think incredibly important stuff you guys are working on there. So kudos to you and the team and Tony. You can find me on X at Sam Calla, SamCallah. Post a lot of analysis there. If you want to read some of the recent reports, I've collaborated with Lynn Alden on a few. And I think those are at LynnAlden.com, the great Lynn Alden. She's great. And so you can find those there if you're interested in reading those. And I also write the News Block, which is a weekly market update with my wife, Natalie Brunel. So you can find that at thenewsblock.substack.com.
Perfect. All right. And everyone listening, check out all of that stuff. His work with Lynn's fantastic. Obviously, you're a gifted writer as well. Lots of good content. So, Sam, thanks, man. We will catch up again sometime soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Michael. Have a great day.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Sam. I know I sure did. Covered a lot of ground. Do me a favor. If you like this episode, if you're enjoying the channel, give us a like, subscribe, share it with someone, leave us a comment. Any sort of engagement is always helpful. Go follow Sam on X. Check out some of the work that he is doing. He's a fantastic writer, has a depth of knowledge in this area, and just tons of great content coming out. If you're interested in Bitcoin self-custody, proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We can help you do it the right way the first time, remove all counterparty risk from your setup. We also help with online privacy, privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option as well for all of your self-sovereignty needs. You can follow us on X as well. We're at thebitcoinway_, and you can message me, follow me there at @theothermjordan. And as always, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.